Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Talk to us today about the Nimrod and crewing of the aircraft and how it was used strategically. We're absolutely delighted and honoured to have Air Chief Marshal Sir Brian Burridge, Knight Commander of the Order of Bath, CBE, ADC, a Fellow of the Chartered Management Institute and a Fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society. Brian Burridge joined the Royal Air Force as a university cadet and was commissioned in 1967. He was a pilot with an operational background in the maritime patrol role, serving on numbers 206 and 120 squadrons. Brian Burridge was promoted to the rank of pilot officer in 1970, to flying officer in 71, flight lieutenant in 72, and to squadron leader in 1979. In 1985, he rose to the rank of Wing Commander. In 1986, he attended the Royal Naval Staff College and then later that year went on to command the Nimrod OCU. Promoted to Group Captain in 1990, he became an officer commanding RAF Kinloss. From 1992, he served in the Ministry of Defence, initially as Deputy Director of Force Doctrine, RAF, and later becoming a Director of Force Development in the Central Staff, before being made Principal Staff Officer to the Chief of Defence Staff in 1994, with the rank of Air Commodore. In February 2002, Brian Burridge was promoted to Air Marshal and appointed Deputy Commander-in-Chief Strike Command, and was in overall command of British forces under Operation Telic during 2003, the invasion of Iraq. He served as an aide-de-camp to Queen Elizabeth II from 2003 to 2006 and was appointed a Knight Commander of the Order of the Bath for his gallant and distinguished service while on operations in Iraq. He retired with the rank of Air Chief Marshal. He then spent 10 years with International Aerospace Defence and Technology Manufacturer Leonardo, chairing two of the group's businesses and holding board positions in the trade associations ADS and the Defence Growth Partnership, where he also chaired its innovation hub. Sir Brian then served as Chief Executive of the Royal Aeronautical Society until 2021. With a first degree in physics, an MBA from the Open University, where he holds an honorary doctorate, Sir Brian was also a research fellow in political science at King's College London and is a visiting professor at the School of Politics and International Relations at the University of Reading. This is a fascinating insight into how the Nimrod was operated, first as a pilot, then as a strategic leader of both Kinloss and the OCU, and later, as we mentioned, in charge of Operation Telic. So a unique insight into the Nimrod. I hope you enjoy this feature. Brian, welcome to Extended.
Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you join us today. But before we get on to talking about the Nimrod, can you just ease us into your RAF career? Where did it start? Where did your flying background come from?
Yes, of course. I come from an Air Force family. my childhood memory, my most vivid childhood memory, is probably my father's last tour at Gaydon, which was a V4 station, and constantly surrounded by aircraft and things to do on an RAF station. And I guess from the age of 8 onwards, it gelled in my brain that I wanted to be a pilot. And I thought probably a military pilot. And I guess from the age of about 10, I was an obsessive modeler. I built a simulator of a Viscount with paper dials and that sort of thing, all the typical stuff. Was particularly interested in sciences at school and then went to university to Manchester, read physics, and I went on a university cadetship. So I was an acting pilot officer with a commission and paid accordingly, which was a Rolls-Royce lifestyle for a student back then at the end of the 60s. As such, as a member of the University Air Squadron, I'd previously done a what was then called a Special Flying Award, so I got a PPL, went into the University Air Squadron, flew the Chipmunk, and then got my degree off to Cranwell, trained on the Jet Provost. It was all, at that stage, straight through jet training.
And Brian, sorry, if I could interrupt you, did you take naturally to flying? Was it something that came quite naturally, or did you have to work at the skill of flight? Because it hits people in different ways. I had to work very, very hard when I attempted to do my PPL. It didn't come naturally to me.
Yeah, I think everybody faces quite a steep learning curve, but I'm gifted with a good pair of hands. And I keep relentlessly saying you just need a good pair of hands and low cunning. And but as you build up experience, it gets easier. And I think probably for me, the key thing was when I became very senior, I flew all the types that I could get my hands on. And to that extent, I left the Air Force, I'd flown 29 types. So I think probably, I did have some natural ability. I was good at ball games and stuff like that.
Right.
But the key thing in any operational aeroplane is you've got to fly the aeroplane with about 5% of your capability, and 95% is operating it. And, you know, if it's a single seater, that's a handful. If it's an airplane like the Nimrod, you're managing the crew, all the sensors, etc. So it is a question of having the capacity and the ability to keep it all together under a fair degree of pressure.
So how did you end up in the maritime role? What happened from your training? Did you have a choice? Was it the channel you were put in, or how did that happen?
Yeah, I said as I progressed through training, I'd actually quite like to fly large aeroplanes. I then did advanced training on the Varsity, which was a development of the Viking just post-war, two big piston engines. And then I did well on the course, so I then became what's known as a staff pilot. I was the only pilot in a Varsity full of navigator students doing what navigators do. And I did that for a couple of years and then became a Jet Provost instructor, again for more than just 2 and a bit years, flight commander, and then I went to the Nimrod from there. So I'd had a fair amount of experience, both as a flying instructor and in sort of managing the workload as a single pilot in a busy aeroplane.
Right, okay. And how did the Nimrod appear on your radar, as the saying goes? Because obviously, four-engine jet from where you're at, was that a particularly challenging conversion?
Not particularly. It takes a bit of getting used to, because suddenly, from flying the Mark V Jet Provost, which is a sort of sports car, you've got an airplane with a lot of momentum, and you have to think ahead, and you've got a crew to worry about. But as an airplane, I had holidayed in Cornwall quite a lot, and on the south coast of Cornwall,
yeah,
just about on the centre line of St Morgan, I'd seen these aeroplanes. I knew what they did through training. You know, we're told about all the various roles, and I thought, you know, this is a real operational role, and that's what really attracted me, I think. As for the aeroplane, well, a great British product, without a doubt, a really robust aeroplane. And bear in mind, my initial conversion was on the Mark One, and it was a pretty solid aeroplane to fly, not particularly good at high level because it wasn't really meant for high Mach numbers at high level with a lot of weight. But at low level, it was very good. And we, of course, flew down to 200 feet over the sea, 300 at night, and you could throw the thing around and it would respond beautifully. It's not quite like fly-by-wire because it's rods and pulleys and but hydraulic actuators.
Yeah.
The flying controls were pretty sensitive, I found. And, you know, instructing on it as well, you to a certain extent, you could let the student get into a problem area without having to take control before things got really interesting. So it's quite forgiving in that respect.
So the apologies for interrupting you there, Brian. When you joined 206 Squadron, did you go through an OCU before you joined the squadron?
Yeah. So the OCU, the Nimrod OCU, is A, interesting because of the breadth of stuff you have to cover, and B, it's very different from other multi-engine OCUs in one area, which I'll come to. But 6 months, getting on for 2 months of ground school, and not only as a pilot or a flight engineer learning the tech of the aeroplane, and that in those days was technical, not technology. In other words, how it works, because you've got to be able to fathom out when you're a long way from home what you might need to do to the systems to get you home. So you've got to have a deep knowledge of the aeroplane. And also maritime operations, in other words, how the aeroplane's used, what sort of decisions you have to make tactically. And even things like recognition. You know, I've spent hours and hours with sitting in front of an overhead projector with fuzzy pictures of Soviet ships coming up, and that sort of thing. Flying, it's about 110 hours. And the difference between the Nimrod OCU and other multi-engine is that after 20 hours as a pilot, you go solo, as it were. In other words, you fly as the captain of the aeroplane with another student in the other seat, because we graduated everybody to first pilot standard. And that meant that took quite a sort of a progression load off the squadrons, because you were getting a product who had proven ability to be a first pilot. And so, unlike other squadrons where someone goes as a co-pilot, stays as a co-pilot, has to undergo another course to become a captain, we're there, we're ready to go when the opportunity arises. Huge reliance on simulators. Now, we're back in analog days, of course, but I won't say the visual was up to it. It was a camera moving across a model. But nevertheless, from a point of view of learning the vices of the aeroplane, the systems, how to get out of trouble, it was pretty good. And that was a full motion simulator. But then we had a maritime crew trainer, which is the fuselage of the aeroplane, with the two pilots sitting at the front, with a sort of desk with a couple of knobs to turn. But they were invaluable training opportunities, because you as a pilot, you can really concentrate on what the TAC team are trying to do, you know, where the strengths and weaknesses are, whether it all fits together. And that's the beginning, really, of your pedigree as an operational pilot. As I say, it's 95% about doing the task as distinct from flying it. So, yeah, that was on the Mark 1, which was essentially analog. I went to 206. I joined 206 in the August of 1978, and that was the summer of the Fastnet yacht disaster. Fastnet race, multiple numbers of ocean-going yachts, hit a big storm off the northwest coast of Scotland. Many of them were dismasted, overturned, etc. And Nimrods were out there as the scene of action commander, because it's a complex iteration, a rescue like that. So you've got to have someone with a situational awareness to be able to control everything. And that, I think, brought the Nimrod into the public eye in that period. But anyway, an average sort of month on 206 in the Mark One, starting at the bottom of the scale, I suppose, Tapestry, 8 hours of fishery protection, pretty much at 200 to 300 feet for 8 hours around the coast of the UK, identifying and photographing fishing boats to ensure that everybody's licensed. And
yeah,
it's quite surprising how frequently they weren't. But you know, after 8 hours of that, your shoulders ache for sure, because you really in order to be efficient, you've got to get from one contact to the next very very speedily. So you know, you work out your track and your bank and all that sort of thing. Search and rescue, always a lot of search and rescue in the north of Scotland, a lot of fishing boats, weather bad in the winter, so inevitably a problem there. Also light aircraft coming across the Atlantic, and it wasn't unusual to have to go out to 30 West to find someone who'd either ditched or needed escorting. Then ServOps, this is the operational stuff, surveillance operations against Soviet ships. And it's a bizarre thing, but they tended to deploy on Monday morning from Murmansk, Kola Peninsula. So it was always Friday night when they'd come into our area of responsibility just to screw up both weekends. So we'd escort them either around the west coast of Scotland or coming down through the channel. If it was an aircraft carrier, we'd photograph it like mad, of course, any new type. We'd lay some sonobuoys in front of it to get its signature and all these sorts of things. But important work. I mean, that's how our intelligence was built up. But the primary role was anti-submarine warfare, and in particular the protection of the independent nuclear deterrent, the Trident boats deploying into their bastions, because inevitably in the Cold War and afterwards, there would be attempts by Soviet / Russian submarines to get on their tails. So to us, and I guess this happened about every 4 or 5 weeks, we would have a combination of intelligence that would say there's a deployment of a hunter-killer submarine due. And in those days, although it was very secret then, it isn't now, we had undersea listening arrays, which would pick up the sound of a nuclear submarine, whether it's whatever its predominant sound source was. It might be a cooling pump or might be generator or alternator, but the trouble is they don't radiate noise uniformly. They lobe, lobing patterns. So
right,
it's the SOSIS picks it up, and you get an ellipse out of that, and it could be hundreds of kilometers long by about half that much wide, and so you'd be told where to lay a barrier. And you'd lay a barrier of sonobuoys, and you'd sit on that barrier for as long as it took before you got a hint of a submarine. And sometimes doing a cold sortie, 8 hours, middle of the night, you've got to keep the crew motivated.
Yeah, yeah.
And once you get a contact, you can track it with your patterns of sonobuoys, and then you hand over covertly to your relief aircraft, and then the game's on. And it sounds simple, but it was actually very difficult as Soviet and Russian submarines became more capable and quieter. It became more difficult to hang on to them. We had a real blow in the middle of the 80s with the Walker Whitworth spy ring in the US who gave to the Soviets the cryptography that we used on the undersea arrays. So they were able to work out which bits of their submarines we were tracking and therefore which bits made a lot of noise. And actually they had a lot of propeller cavitation that they didn't really understand when they say in subsequent submarines they designed then out. And the Victor III and the Akula coming into the late 80s were really, really slippery submarines. They were very quiet. They're huge. I don't know, 3 football pitches, but extremely quiet. And that was our bread and butter, particularly as you have a sort of pair of scales, your concern about the sanctity of the nuclear deterrent versus the difficulty of tracking these things.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Cinderella syndrome, and that was very much the case in the Second World War when Coastal Command were perhaps unlucky not to receive better equipment, more research, faster. Although they did pretty well, got ASV-1, the first anti-surface radar. In terms of the initial quality of the aeroplane, the range, the ability to close the gap in between the Faroes and Iceland, they were all real problems, and hence the Cinderella sobriquet.
Yeah.
I think we regarded ourselves as Cinderella for a different reason, and that was because what we were doing was so highly classified, nobody knew about it in the rest of the Air Force. I mean, we were commanded and controlled by the Navy at Northwood on operations. So there wasn't very much understanding in the Air Force of what we did. So we kind of just got on with it and put up with the fact that nobody knew what we did, even though it was probably one of the more disruptive roles in terms of your family life or whatever. So, and then there was a particularly difficult period in the 90s, as there was a contemplation we would replace the Nimrod MR2 in about 95 to 98. And you may know that the original plan was a thing called Nimrod 2000. But actually before that, there was a prospect of a quick buy of the Lockheed P-7. The P-7 was to be the US Navy's replacement for the P-3, and it was looking as though it might come to fruition in the right timescale. And unfortunately, that meant that the procurement staff did not determine it was sensible in the light of that possible replacement to upgrade the acoustic system and upgrade the central tactical system. And I'm talking about the Mark II.
Yeah.
Because technology was moving very fast. So against those really slippery Soviet and Russian submarines, you know, we were almost working with one hand behind our back.
Yeah. But
the strength of the Nimrod force was the quality of the crews and the fact that we weren't in any way hidebound by tactics or whatever. You were expected to be innovative, creative, and you were expected always to hang on to the target.
Yeah.
And we would do a prosecution. Sometimes, invariably, it would be in concert with the US. Out of Keflavik in Iceland, and occasionally if the submarine as a target was declared to NATO, then the Norwegians would join, maybe the Dutch. But essentially most of them were US-UK prosecutions. And from a UK point of view, everything we do in the aeroplane is recorded in those days on 1-inch magnetic tape. So all the sensor inputs are recorded, and particularly the acoustics. And after we'd done a prosecution, then the Joint Acoustic Analysis Centre down at Farnborough would go through all the tapes, they would reconstruct the mission, the whole thing. You know, if we'd done 20 sorties, there'd be 20 sorties worth. And they'd come up to Kinloss, the execs of all the crews would be in the briefing room, and you've seen Top Gun and, you know, how they debrief on the range. Well, it's very similar to that. Go right the way through. And if you were unlucky enough to lose the target, that's there for everyone to see, and you feel about that big. I was lucky in that I was a flight commander on 120 at that stage, had an elite crew, and we would normally be able to put right anybody else's wrongs.
Same
as running the OCU, because most of the staff crews were really, really good.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
But when you got into those more senior roles, how did you use that experience to use the Nimrod more strategically as an asset?
Well, the primary requirement was to have the ability to maintain the security of the independent nuclear deterrent. And so whatever we did, and post the Cold War, the Soviet Navy didn't stop. It was still the Soviet Navy for about 3 years, and then became the Russian Navy. And the Russian Navy the submarine force retained their capability. And you will probably remember when the Cold War ended and the Soviet Empire collapsed, then the armed forces collapsed with them, except for the submarine force. Submarine force, in a sense, their economy was in tatters, and they had to sort of constrain their aspirations to what they felt were really important. And they felt submarine force was important because it could do offense and defense. It could stop another nation's nuclear deterrent working. And so that was regarded as important. So when I was more senior, when people come up with some good ideas for what the Nimrod should do, you still have to remind people, you've got to be able to do that. You've got to be able to protect the deterrent.
Yeah.
Now, a number of other roles opened up. We haven't discussed the Falklands War. I was not on the force during the Falklands War. I was commanding Cambridge UAS. But there's a classic case of the airplane would deploy, use air-to-air refueling, and go very long distances and provide surface surveillance for the Royal Navy, for the task force, in much the same way as we did in Gulf War I, moving up the Gulf, keeping a clear picture for them so that they knew where the bad guys might come from. But as we got into, say, the 2000s, after Gulf War II, Iraq War, then we have a long period of counterinsurgency in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then the Nimrod is involved in supporting special forces, because by that stage the sensor fit had improved, and we were always, those of us who'd been there and done it, who then in senior positions, were distinctly mindful of the flexibility of the aeroplane. So Gulf War I gave us an electro-optical sensor for the first time. Up to that point, it was the Mark I eyeball and liquid film cameras. Wet film cameras. Once you get a good electro-optical sensor, which was continually upgraded, then you're in a position to provide situational awareness and to provide it over a long period, over a large area, particularly in counterinsurgency, where you need to understand pattern of life because only then can you really understand who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. So the Nimrod's a very flexible aeroplane because of its comms, because of its situational awareness, and just running very quickly. It was used in the Balkans campaign on Sharp Guard, where it was policing the embargo on weapons, fuel, and sometimes food going into the former Yugoslavia. It was used in counter-narcotics very successfully. An important contribution that the UK made to counter-narcotics in the Caribbean. And it sounds odd, but actually the former colonial countries of the Caribbean, the Dutch, the French, and ourselves, still had ties, air routes, banking, etc. in the Caribbean nations. And that was a ready route for drugs, and particularly to the UK. The UK, by the counter-narcotics community in the US and in Europe, the UK was regarded as almost an open goal because of the lack of local surveillance and the lack of enforcement. And even now, a kilogram of cocaine is worth about $120,000 in the UK market, whereas it's worth about 40 or 50 in the rest of Europe and only less than 20 in the US, because fentanyl's everywhere in the US. But just shows you, you know, when you're in a policy position, you've got to think now, what do we need to do to address this? How do we retain the confidence of our allies that we're doing something about it? So counter-narcotics was useful. Long-range search and rescue. I mean, we had a number of different occasions because people's imagination had been opened up with the Falklands and the use of Ascension. You know, suddenly when there's a difficult task on.
Yeah.
And just mentioning the Falklands, I flew the first large jet aeroplane to Port Stanley and landed on the AM2 matting.
Wow.
Special landing technique, which did not include the very large bounce that I managed to execute. But nevertheless, it was about 5,500 feet of plastic.
Yeah.
And then we staged at Ascension. We obviously had three refueling brackets. But we decided that I'd convince the MOD that we would do a single hop home. And luckily, there was enough AAR available at Ascension. So we flew 18 hours and 15 minutes direct from Ascension to, I can't remember whether we went to Kinloss or St. Morgan on that occasion.
Yeah, wow.
Because we wanted to prove we could do it.
Yeah.
Not because it was fancy, but because we needed to demonstrate the operational relevance of the aeroplane and not have to have a detachment down in the Falklands permanently.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I understand.
But yeah. In all of this, when you're trying to work at the policy level, you have to say, well, okay, what's operationally relevant? What's economically relevant and what's politically relevant? Because unless you tick those three boxes, you're wasting your time, really.
It's fascinating. One question I forgot to ask you, Brian, you mentioned it briefly there about working with the Navy. Obviously, before we started recording, I told you about my father. You spent a bit of time at the Royal Naval Staff College. How did that experience work, and what did you learn to bring into the maritime patrol environment?
Well, I previously, while I was on 206, must have been the autumn of 78, or no, it may have been in the spring of 79, I was seconded to an Admiral's staff for Exercise Ocean Safari. This is when we take three U.S. carrier battle groups across the Atlantic to the Norwegian coast, sit there in Vestfjord, and go through an exercise iteration of the Soviets coming out of Svetomorsk. And so I was on the Admiral's flagship, which was the Mighty Hermes, equipped with Seeking, doing Seeking Jez, as we called it then, the Jezebel boy, the original Sonoboy. And I did that for about a month, so I had an inkling. And normally, they always stick a Nimrod guy and a Harrier guy on the Navy course because they see that as the sort of common threads, if you like. It was a good course. It was 6 months, which was a good thing compared with the Royal Air Force one, which was 10 months. I learned a lot about the legacy grief in the Navy about having lost the argument over carriers in, late 60s, 70s. And the debate at the time, and nobody foresaw, this is 85 into 86, nobody was foreseeing the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the debate at the time was whether the UK's defence and security strategy and policy should be around a maritime strategy or a continental strategy. As you know, I mean, with the way we ended up at the end of the Second World War, we had the North German plane, and we kept a couple of divisions in Germany and exercised in the areas where they would fight, because we expected the Third Shock Army to come across the border, and gradually it would be a war of attrition as we got pushed back. Separately, there was all this stuff in the maritime role, and particularly nuclear, and particularly carrier battle groups coming out of the Kola Peninsula. And so there was a philosophical debate continually about this. And as Air Force officers, we sat somewhere in the middle, really, because we had a foot in both camps. That really was the constant drama. And then the Greenwich had a particularly good academic approach to the course. So we had a small academic staff of high quality who were experts in maritime doctrine, but also international relations. So it was very stimulating. And Greenwich is a great place to be. It really was. And a bunch, not as many as we would have now, but about five or six other nations, ranging from a Japanese officer through to the obvious USN officer.
Right. Okay. Wonderful. Wonderful. So how would you summarize the impact of the Nimrod during that Cold War, that post-war and up until the 90s, the impact that the Nimrod had on Cold War operations?
Yeah, I mean, it was a by-service effort, if you like, because we would coordinate with the Royal Navy. And if we've got a contact coming around the Cape, the North Cape, then, of course, a Nimrod can get there first. A towed array frigate takes a long time. But once it's there, the towed array detection capability is really good for getting the attack solution sorted out when you mix it with the Nimrod's intelligence as well. Also, our own submarines, SSNs, would participate. And so, but the Nimrod, I think it was often regarded as the glue. We'd get there quickly. We could stay there for ages. We could get very accurate tracking and then attack solutions, and we practice attacking covertly just to prove we can. And sometimes we would unambiguously wake up the Soviet submarine by them realizing they'd just been attacked, because you don't have a magnetic anomaly detector, and you get a big swing on that sensor when you go over the top of all that steel, so you know how accurate you've been.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think in its primary role, it's compelling. B, There's been a number of search and rescue disasters that have required a scene of action commander, and the Piper Alpha was a classic one. Mm-hmm. See the flexibility with which you can use its surveillance and situational awareness to support other activity like special forces, like counter-narcotics. So it was a sort of mainstay of combat capability, in my view.
Now, before I let you go, Brian, this has been an absolutely fascinating insight into the Nimrod strategically and operationally. But I know you mentioned to me that you've submitted a paper to the RAF Historical Journal on the Nimrod's role in the immediate Cold War period. But as you've kept reminding us, even the Berlin Wall coming down and the Soviet Union breaking up, you still had the Russian Navy operating quite aggressively. What's your view about the time after the Nimrods were scrapped and before the P-8 arrived on the scene? How do you look back on that period?
I regard that as a travesty. It was a decade where we didn't have our main anti-submarine warfare tool, at a time where Russian boats were becoming even more spectacularly quiet, some titanium boats starting to come out. So from the point of view of looking after our independent, remember, nuclear deterrent, that wasn't smart. Secondly, yeah, it undermined significantly the way in which we were viewed by the US and particularly the US Navy. Thirdly, there were new things happening. There were a lot of undersea cables by that stage carrying a lot of globally important data, not least financial data. And as we've seen, fighting in the grey space as they do, the Russians have no fear of interdicting that. So, to my mind, that was a travesty, nothing short of that.
Well, I'm really, really looking forward to the publication of that journal. So we'll keep an eye out for that. Before I let you go, Brian, is there any way that listeners can find you on the internet or follow you on social media or anything like that?
LinkedIn is the best way.
LinkedIn's the best way to watch out for you.
Can I just enlighten you with one area that you may be surprised about that I haven't mentioned?
Of course.
This will appeal to any of your listeners who are really interested in the way aeroplanes operate. Nimrod had four pretty big spay engines, 12,500 pounds of thrust, if I remember rightly. And so if we were on an eight-hour mission, we'd be at 185,000 pounds, climb out, get the crews, probably for about an hour to the operating area up on the North Cape. Go into the descent, the first thing we do is shut down one of the outboard engines to save fuel. We then go about our business laying sonobuoys or whatever, and after about an hour, we would throttle back another outboard engine. So we got one shut down, one throttled back. When we got to a particular weight, we would shut down the running outboard engine. So we're just flying on two inboard engines. And the point at which you do that is known as critical weight. And the reason it's critical is that you can climb out on one engine if one of those inboards fails. And we used to practice that from low level, not with them shut down, but with probably with one shut down, two throttled back, to prove, to show people a technique, because you climb at V-min drag plus five, and if you are sloppy, you'll get the wrong side of the drag curve and a disaster happens. But that is an aspect of operating the aeroplane which we take for granted, and first time you have someone flying as a passenger who flies in other aeroplanes, can't believe it. but they were.
Yeah, I'm sure. Fascinating insight. Brian, it's been an absolute delight. Thank you so much for your time today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that feature with Sir Brian Burridge. Of course, it was a unique opportunity to talk to somebody who'd not only flown and operated the Nimrod, but also had worked in a strategic senior leadership role in using the Nimrod as a tactical tool for the defence of the nation. We'd love to thank everybody who's participated in our series Cold War Coastal Command, which now comes to an end. It's been a fascinating insight to seeing how Coastal Command had operated after the war and through, of course, that Cold War period. Of course, there is now the untold additional part of the Maritime Patrol solution, which of course eventually ended up being the P-8 Poseidon in RAF service. And that may well be something that we look to cover at a later date. But for now, that's it on the Cold War Coastal Command series. We would, of course, like to thank White Hearts and Mikoki at the Aviation Historium for their support. You can, of course, find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter. And you can find Ellie, Tim and Gareth on the extended Twitter, Facebook, Threads and Instagram feeds. So that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. And remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.